but the Hindu denies absolute truth. So right there at its core, it's contradictory. Okay? Now, let's say that we find a contradictory aspect to, let's say Joe Schmo's a Christian, and we find that he's got some contradictions in his thought. Let's say he believes, he's the type of Christian who believes that water baptism saves, baptismal regeneration, which obviously is not a biblical idea, but this guy believes in that. Yet he believes you have to freely accept Christ to be saved, and he also believes in baptizing infants before the age of accountability, okay? Those are contradictions in his thought. Does that show that Christianity is contradictory in its essential aspects? No, because now we're talking about peripheral issues. If you can show it's a contradiction to say that God is three persons, or that God the Son became a man, that would kill Christianity. But believe me, after 2,000 years of trying, I'm not going to bet on the anti-Christian thinkers to prove a logical contradiction in Christianity on its essential points. Number two, explanatory power. Does the worldview adequately explain the data of reality? With number one, what I said of the logical consistency, you apply that to atheism? Atheism says there is no truth. There is no God, there is no truth, but atheism is true. It's contradictory right there. Explanatory power, does atheism explain everything adequately? No. If atheism is true, there's no such thing as invisible, non-material truths. There's no such thing as, you know, so much, you know, the atheist says there is no such thing as love. Because an atheist can't take love, put it in a test tube, weigh it, experiment with it. But that same atheist, when he leaves the lab, he's going to go home and tell his wife he loves her. Now, is he lying? Or is it just that he argues against love because he knows it leads too close to the throne room of God, and then when he goes home, he becomes honest and acknowledges that he does love his wife? But explanatory power, this is why ancient atheistic materialism of the Milesian school, the Greek Milesian school, was refuted so swiftly by Greek philosophers, because it was viewed as a reductionist philosophy. It reduced everything to one component. Matter only exists. And by the time guys like Socrates and Plato came on the scene, they were laughing. How could only matter exist? You think good, the good, and the beautiful, you think those things are physical things? Rights and wrongs, you think those things are physical things? Atheism was thoroughly refuted in ancient times. At this particular point, it's not, believe me, atheism barely has a pulse right now. You sit down and talk with most of the leading atheist thinkers, you get a few of the modernists, they're the ones that'll still take debates, but most of the leading cutting-edge atheist thinkers are more in the postmodern camp. You sit down and talk with them, you think you're talking to a New Ager. You don't feel like you're talking to an atheist. You know, the atheist profs, the traditional atheist profs that think they know everything there is to know about the universe, they're becoming the dinosaurs on college campuses. They've got tenure, they can't be fired. After they die, they're going to be replaced by a postmodern / new age breed of younger anti-Christian philosophers. Okay, livability. Can you live consistently with your worldview? Can atheists really live consistently with the view that man is mere molecules of motion? Okay. If an atheist gives you a pail of dirt and asks you to move it and down the steps and fill a pile up somewhere, and you go down the steps and you trip and you drop the dirt, okay, he might be a little bit upset with you, but he's probably not going to be all ticked off. Now, if you're carrying the atheist son, little baby son, down the steps, and you trip and you fall, you tell me he's not going to have a different response? Now, if something like that happened and I accidentally dropped an atheist son, I would not tell him. You know, I would say call 911, I would not tell him, listen, your son is mere molecules of motion, just like the dirt is, so you shouldn't have any other, that's not a time for philosophical debate. But the fact of the matter is, if you were to, by the way, don't get me wrong, I'm not advocating dropping atheist sons. Okay, they're created in God's image. They're created in God's image, just like Christian sons and daughters. But what I'm getting at is the atheist acts like a Christian when harm is done to his children. Okay? So it's not livable. Francis Schaeffer argued if a worldview is not livable, trash it. You know, Francis Schaeffer argued lots of people deny Christianity, but they all live as if Christianity were true. And that's what Cornelius Van Til, Francis Schaeffer's teacher, meant by saying they all live on borrowed capital from the Christian worldview. Okay, existential power. Does the worldview provide a sense of meaning for life? In life? Does it make sense of our moral and rational experience? Does it meet our emotional and societal needs? I'd just say no for atheism. I mean, does it provide a sense of meaning in life? To a lot of atheists, they really think it does. I mean, isn't this great? We can go to atheist conferences and travel halfway around the globe, and we can take debates and all this other stuff to stand up and defend the fact that God doesn't exist, and after we die, we cease to exist. I don't know what kind of game they're playing. And I told them to their faces at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill campus, it's an atheist conference. Over 200 of the world's leading atheists sitting down. I think there was 12 Christians there because it was an atheist conference. A few guys from Norman Geisler's school found out about it and showed up. But I told them, I said, I don't even know why you guys get up in the morning. I understand why I have Jesus bumper stickers and this stuff. I don't even know why you guys get up in the morning if you don't believe that God exists. You know, I think Paul's right. If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Why go on a world tour? So I don't think atheism provides a real sense of meaning in life. Eventually the whole universe is going to blow up. It definitely doesn't make sense of our moral and rational experience. We act like there is truth. We act like there are certain things that are wrong and right, even though they deny them. And I don't think it meets our emotional and societal needs. Let's face it, the atheist is going to talk about the witch hunts, the Inquisition, the Crusades. I'll tell you, atheism applied to government in the Soviet Union and China in less than 100 years killed way more people than all the rotten things done by people who professed to be believers but really weren't over a period of 2,000 years. The only benefit of the doubt I'll give the atheist is this. There is a worldview when applied to human governments that will kill at a faster and more vicious rate than atheism. And that is New Age pantheism, this worldly pantheism. The only reason why the communists slaughtered more than Hitler and the Nazis did, Hitler and the Nazis did not have a long time span to do it in, so they killed their 20 million or so in a very short amount of time, given enough. But the problem is that Richard Terrell wrote that book, Resurrecting the Third Reich, where he argues that the New Age belief system was basically the belief system of the Nazis, and we are resurrecting the Nazi movement on a global scale with a few cosmetic changes. We're resurrecting it on a global scale through the New Age movement. So he's basically arguing that there's going to be a global Holocaust through the New Age movement. Okay, and then number five, societal impact. Does it enhance freedom, order, and human rights? The Christian worldview does. I do not think that could be said about atheism. Just look at Stalin. I don't think it could be said about pantheism. Just look at Hitler and Auschwitz. Turn to the page, the failure of atheistic arguments. Just keep in mind that most atheist thinkers today are really not atheists, they're agnostics, because of the failure of atheism to prove its case. See, atheism is self-refuting, because if you could definitely prove that God does not exist, you'd have to be all-knowing to do that. Yeah, to a certain degree, you'd have to be omnipresent. I mean, you could say, well, I looked for God all over the universe and I didn't find him. Well, maybe when you were in one part of the universe, God was in another part of the universe. You know, you'd have to be at every place at once, not just the physical realm, but the spiritual realm as well. So, in other words, you'd have to be God to disprove God's existence. But even agnosticism, the belief that man cannot know if God exists, hard agnosticism is self-refuting because you must know something about God to know that nothing can be known about him. And, you know, the agnostic is right when he says, look, if an infinite God exists, the finite man can't reach the infinite God on his own. He wouldn't be able to find him. Well, they're right, but that's what Jesus said. Matthew 19, 25-26, they asked, well, how can man be saved? Jesus said, this is impossible for man, but all things are possible with God. So just because the finite man is so limited that he can't find God on his own, doesn't mean that the infinite God is limited. The infinite God could reveal himself to the finite man. There's no problem there at all. We already talked about God as a product of man's imagination. Ludwig Feuerbach and those views, the response that explains false idols, but no one would wish for the God of the Bible, the convicting God of the Bible. It's not actually an argument against God's existence. Rather, it's an attempt by atheists to explain why so many people believe in a non-existing God. Whatever the case, we dealt with that earlier. Even if it were valid, even if there were some substance to it, it would still fall to the genetic fallacy that wherever the belief, if you could show the belief came from an unreliable source, it must be false. Okay? Now, that's not necessarily true. You could have the town liar could be running through the theater screaming the theater is on fire, and it might really be on fire. Just because you prove that the town liar said it doesn't automatically mean it's false. It's like the boy who cried wolf. Okay? So that's the genetic fallacy. Whatever the case, we also talked about A.J. Ayres, at least logical positivism, and the verification principle, where truth can only be found through the five senses, and that the verification principle itself cannot be proved through the five senses. It fails its own test for truth. We talked about Sartre. Bertrand Russell, brilliant thinker, but when it came to denying God, he argued like a third grader. He said, if everything needs a cause, then so does God. True. If everything does need a cause, then God does need a cause, because God is something, right? But then if God doesn't need a cause, neither does the universe. Well, let me tell you right now, if any Christian who argues that everything needs a cause, therefore God caused the universe, you need to get out of philosophy and not take debates until you go back to school. No knowledgeable Christian thinker has ever argued that everything needs a cause. Christian thinkers have argued things like everything that has a beginning needs a cause, everything that is dependent on something else for its existence needs a cause. What it comes down to is that what they're saying is everything that's an effect needs a cause. But eventually, you have to arrive at an uncaused cause. That's what God is. God is an uncaused cause, the uncaused cause of everything else that exists. So we don't argue that everything needs a cause. We just argue that everything that its existence is contingent or dependent needs a cause. And so eventually, you have to arrive at a totally independent being. But then Russell says, if God doesn't need a cause, neither does the universe. That's like saying if God doesn't need a cause, then neither does an apple. No, the apple needs a cause. See, there's good reasons. We're not just arbitrarily saying God doesn't need a cause just because he's God. We're saying that because things come into existence and go out of existence, something, some unchanging being has to exist throughout all eternity that has no possibility of non-existence, and that grounds the existence of everything else. So we're not just arbitrarily saying God doesn't need a cause. There's good reasons why God doesn't need a cause, just as there are good reasons why the universe does need a cause. The universe is a changing thing. I mean, let's face it, you know, if the universe doesn't need a cause, and the universe didn't have a beginning, and it always existed, okay, then to reach the present moment now, if the universe is eternal, time would have had to have progressed through an infinite number of moments. But you could never traverse an infinite number of moments, because no matter how many moments you pass, there'd still be an infinite number more of more moments to pass. Okay? The fact that we reach the present moment now means there had to be a first moment. The universe had to have a beginning. So God existed outside of time and eternity, and he created time when he created the first changing beings. Okay? So only that which has a beginning needs a cause. The universe had a beginning. Skip over the problem of evil issue. We'll talk about that a little bit further on. Albert Camus, the French existentialist, he wrote a book, The Plague. We argued that man's dilemma is that since God allowed this, it was a novel, since God allowed the plague, to fight the plague is to fight God. Therefore, to be religious, one must be anti-humanitarian. The Christian response is this: look, God allowed the plague of evil and human suffering for purposes of a greater good, but part of that greater good is to join God as he combats evil and human suffering. So the Christian response: God is fighting the plague of sin and its effects. The godly man will fight it also. So Albert Camus' priest saying that we can't, God allowed this plague to come, and he allows things for a greater good, therefore we can't interfere with God's greater good and fight the plague, that's baloney. Part of the greater good is getting godly men and women to take a stand against that which is evil and to try to save lives. Now, I would argue that the atheist doctor in Albert Camus' The Plague novel, I don't know why in the world he has any incentive to risk his life and fight the plague and try to heal people. Okay, we'll pick it up there. And obviously, we only have an hour left, so we're just going to do the best job we can. We'll just give a little bit of an overview on some of this. But I've recommended some reading. We got some books here, and there's the website, biblicaldefense.org, where you can download hundreds of lectures on this material. So anything that we miss in these lectures, you can pick up there. We're talking about refuting atheism. Now we're on the page that deals with arguments from contradictory attributes. These are the kinds of arguments that are being used a lot by atheists today. The number one argument against God, of course, is the problem of evil. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But the argument from the incoherency of the portrait of the Christian God argues that there's something contradictory about God's attributes, and therefore, God is impossible. You know, God can't exist. That kind of God can't exist. Michael Martin uses a real interesting one in the Theism versus Atheism, the Internet debate. You can still go to Internet Infidels or BiblicalDefense.com and read through that debate. I wish we had more of these in print, but he argues that if God is all-knowing, he must know everything, including how to swim. But if you have to have a body to know how to swim, and so God doesn't know everything. And it's therefore the Christian God can't exist. And when I respond, he's a philosopher, he should know better. I say, you got a category mistake there. Dr. Michael Martin of Boston University was confusing, he headed the department there too, the philosophy department, but he's confusing knowledge with how that knowledge is attained. Okay, so Mark Spitz knows how to swim because he learned by experience. God eternally knew how to swim innately. He just, everything God knows, he knows innately. To be all-knowing means God could never learn anything as God. I mean, God could add a human nature like Jesus did, and in his human nature he may need to learn a lot of things. But God, as God, can't learn anything because he already knows it. If he learned something today, then that means he didn't know it yesterday, and then he wouldn't be omniscient, all-knowing. So God, throughout all eternity, innately knew how to swim. See, he could have, if God wanted to, he could have wrote the book of swimming in the Bible, and he could have wrote exactly how to swim. Okay? This is right. You don't have to go past Genesis 3, and you can get a response to this form of argumentation. Adam and Eve, because they sinned, God said, now they're like one of us, knowing good and evil. How did man learn good and evil? See, he didn't recognize good as good, because good was all there was. He didn't even recognize good as good until first he did the evil. Then he recognized there's two categories, good and evil. Well, God knew that already. Does that mean God sinned? No. God innately knew good and evil. Humans learned it experientially. Okay, here's a common one. An all-powerful God can do anything, even create a rock that he cannot lift. But if he can't lift this rock, he's not all-powerful. Therefore, no all-powerful God exists. Okay? The problem there is with the definition of God being all-powerful. Let me say this. It's going to sound heretical, but it's only because we don't do enough in-depth theological preaching from our pulpits today. We're too quick on following the latest Christian fad, which is usually doesn't involve a whole lot of thinking. But the fact of the matter is, most Christians think that because God's all-powerful, that means he can do anything at all. But the fact of the matter, the Bible teaches there's a lot of things God cannot do. God cannot lie. God cannot change his mind. God cannot fail. God cannot sin. Okay? So when we say, in other words, God cannot do anything that implies limitations or failure or evil. So to be all-powerful means God can do anything he sets out to do. God can do anything that does not contradict his good nature, or God can do anything that is not contradictory in itself. For instance, if God could sin, that would contradict his good nature, so God can't do that. Even God cannot create square circles, because by definition, there cannot be a square circle. Okay? So even God cannot do the impossible. God can do much of what's humanly impossible for us, but if something's impossible by definition, an absurdity can't exist. God can't actualize that absurdity. So God can only do that which is consistent. God can accomplish everything that is consistent with his good nature and that is not contradictory by itself. To create a rock that he can't lift is contradictory. For an all-powerful being to create a rock that an all-powerful being can't lift. There's no such thing as a rock that an all-powerful being can't lift. As creator, he will always be able to master his creation. Anything he creates, he will be able to master it. He can create a rock of enormous size. Go look at the Rock of Gibraltar and this moon rock that's floating around the earth. God can still lift it. Okay? So the problem there, see, that you have to find the problem either in the premises or the conclusion. If the conclusion doesn't follow from the premises, here the problem is in that first premise that an all-powerful God can do anything. Even when the Bible talks about that God can do anything, it's just a way of saying that God is all-powerful, but it's not always meant to be taken literally. God being all-powerful means he can never fail. But if you say he can never fail, so in other words, it's like saying if God is all-powerful, he can do anything, even not do something. Because that's what number two is it's a not do something. Or number three, not lift the rock. So as it's a semantical little game that's being played there. So basically it's like saying if God is all-powerful, he can do anything, even fail. No, God can never fail. God can do anything that doesn't involve failure or contradiction. Okay? You know, we could do something that God can't do. It's called sin. It doesn't make God less powerful because he can't sin. That makes him more powerful. Okay, here's another atheist argument. Either something is good because God wills it, but then God went eeny, meeny, miny, mo, and the good is arbitrary. God said, you know, I think I'll make killing evil and feeding the hungry good. But God could have said, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, okay, I'll make killing innocent people good and feeding hungry people evil. He could have. And some Christians, by the way, hold that view. That's a messed up view. It's called voluntarism. that God's will, something is good just because God wills it. God wills it, it's good automatically, period, and they just leave it at that. Or the other horn of the dilemma is, or God wills it because it is good. But then the good is a standard above God, so God's not really God because there's a moral law above him. This is a false dilemma. It's the either-or fallacy. They act like there's only two options. There's really a third option. You see, God, you know, because you're left with either the good is arbitrary, it's not really good, or the good is above God, and then God's not really God. Well, God wills it. Here's our response. God wills it because it's consistent with his own good nature. See, the only thing God's will submits to is God's good nature. And so we're not voluntarists where God's will comes first. We're essentialists. God's nature, God's good nature comes first. And God could only will that which is consistent with his good nature. God by nature is good. So God wills it because it's consistent with his own good nature. So the standard is not above God, nor is the standard arbitrary. Instead, God is the standard. That's what the Bible means when it says God is good. Okay? If we read our Bibles close enough, we will find that these ancient prophets refuted these brilliant contemporary atheists long before these boys ever walked the earth. Okay? And when the scripture says God is good, that's saying a whole lot. We can't even get into that. It's just basically God is it. We have attributes. God is his attributes. We have love because God gave us love. We have goodness because God gave us goodness. But God is love because he's the source of all love. God is goodness because he's the source of all goodness. God is holiness. That's what we mean when we say that God is a simple being. Okay, Anthony Flew. So these guys walk into, and by the way, I don't even know if I should bring this up anymore. Anthony Flew now believes God exists. 81 years old, possibly the world's leading philosopher. It's between him and Alvin Plantinga, a Christian philosopher from Notre Dame. But Anthony Flew, the British philosopher, now believes that God exists. Not a Christian yet, so keep praying for him. But it should be Anthony. There's really no H. It's not really Anthony. But he said there's no way to falsify the invisible gardener. A believer and a non-believer walk into the wilderness and they find these beautiful flowers growing. So the believer says, well, there must be a gardener. And the non-believer says, no, there's no gardener. That just naturally grew there. So they camp out to see who's right. And they wait a few days and no gardener. So the non-believer says, well, therefore no gardener exists. The believer says, no, there's a gardener. And he comes in here each day to water the plants and stuff, but I think he's invisible. And so they get bloodhounds, and they get a fence, and they put it around there, and still no evidence of him. The believer says, well, maybe he's not only invisible, but he's not detectable by the senses. It just keeps going on and on. So eventually the non-believer says, tell me something. What's the difference between your invisible gardener and no gardener at all? So that's the attack on Christianity. This sounds real good, but it fails to admit the possibility of fulfilled prophecies. Because kind of the invisible gardener is making himself known by telling the future through his prophets. I witnessed miracles. Anthony Flew is famous for updating David Hume's arguments against miracles. And Jesus' bodily resurrection from the dead. No scholar that I know of wants to call the Apostle Paul a liar. And everybody admits Paul wrote 1 Corinthians in 55 AD, and there he quotes an ancient creed that predates it by a couple decades, where he says that over 500 people saw Jesus alive from the dead. So sounds to me like the invisible gardener became visible and revealed himself to mankind, and just in case we didn't get it, he rose from the dead to prove that he had risen from the dead. By the way, Anthony Flew debated Gary Habermas, one of my old professors from Liberty University, twice on the bodily resurrection of Christ, and Habermas obviously defended the resurrection. Flew argued against it, and Habermas won hands down in both debates. They're both in book form right now. The first one was just a formal debate at Liberty University in the early 80s, and Harper and Row published it. Terry L. Meathey edited, another one of my professors from Liberty. I think it was the resurrection debate, I think. And then the second one was on the John Ankerberg show. And you can get the video on it, but they also have it in book form as well. You have to remind yourself when you watch it that Anthony Flew is considered one of the world's greatest living philosophers, because he looks like a guy who's confused and doesn't know what he's talking about. And sometimes he just smiles and puts up his shoulders when Habermas says something. But that's what happened when brilliant people like the Bertrand Russells, the Anthony Flews, try to argue against the God of the Bible. They don't look so smart anymore if their opponent is a knowledgeable guy who's done his homework. Okay, let's see. Let's move on to refuting moral relativism. Refuting moral relativism. We're really running low on time, so I'm going to really try to rush through this. Moral relativism teaches each individual decides for themselves what is right and what is wrong. Let me say this. If the atheist says, look, the moral law, we make moral decisions, the moral law, the moral standard ultimately comes from each individual. Well, there's a problem with that, because then one individual could not condemn the actions of another individual. We can't condemn Adolf Hitler or Osama bin Laden. But the atheist wants to condemn Adolf Hitler and Osama bin Laden. So then they could say, well, maybe the moral law comes from each society. That's the ultimate standard. Certainly not God, but just the society. But then there's a problem there, because then one society, like America, can't condemn the actions of another society as wrong, like Nazi Germany or the Taliban. But the atheist wants us to be able to do that. So then they might say, well, maybe the moral law comes from a world consensus. But the world consensus, it's not infallible. It's been wrong in the past. We once thought the world consensus was the world is flat, that the world, that the sun revolved around the earth, not the other way around, that slavery was perfectly permissible, and a woman didn't have rights. She was the property of the man. Now, the world consensus was wrong in the past. What makes us think it's going to be right now? And by the way, even atheists live like there's a moral law above the world consensus, because they protest to try to change the world for the better. Skip down to the bottom of that page. If we wish to condemn the actions of the past, and the atheists do, they'll say at times the world today is better than it was in the past, because our atheist agenda is coming about, but we need it to be better in the future. We want it to be better tomorrow. So if we wish to condemn the actions of the past and try to build a better future, then the moral law is not only above all individuals, all societies, and any world consensus, but it doesn't change with time. And the moral law is not descriptive. It's not like the laws of nature that describe the way things are. It's prescriptive. It prescribes the way things ought to be. When you go to get a prescription drug, you need a prescriber. It's the same with prescriptive laws, moral laws. You need a moral lawgiver. You need a commander to give the commands. And so, whatever the case, we need a moral lawgiver above all individuals, above all societies, and above any world consensus, and has to be a moral lawgiver that doesn't change with time, i.e., an unchanging, eternal moral lawgiver. Okay? Miracles. The atheist argues against miracle. A miracle is just the act of God interrupting or superseding the ordinary events of nature. David Hume and Benedict Spinoza both argued that miracles violate natural laws. That's Spinoza, and therefore they're impossible. David Hume said no reasonable person would accept an exception to natural laws, so wouldn't believe in them. Well, modern science no longer thinks the way these guys thought. These guys were at, this was when modernism and the Enlightenment was at its height. And so they thought natural laws prescribed the way things have to be. Now natural laws are viewed as descriptive. They're generalizations. They describe the way things normally occur, but they don't prescribe the way things have to occur. In other words, there's much more humility in our science. We no longer see the universe as a predictable clock or a machine that has to work a certain way. Now, God is above the laws of nature. He can supersede or interrupt them as he chooses. Once one accepts the existence of God, miracles automatically are possible. miracles confirm faith in the true God and authenticate the message and the messenger. Sometimes they alleviate suffering if God chooses to heal, but miracles are not performed to entertain. We have reliable eyewitness testimony confirming the reality of Jesus' miracles and resurrection, the deaths of the martyrs, those who witnessed Jesus' miracles. Turn to the next page on evil and human suffering. Two main arguments here from evil that have been used to try to argue that God did not exist. I just give 14 points, we'll touch on some of them, but one of the arguments is this. God created everything that exists. Evil is something that exists. Therefore, God created evil. Well, we Christians don't believe God created evil. So how do we respond to that? Well, the response to it is this. God did not create evil. Therefore, God created everything that exists in itself. Evil is not something that exists in itself. It exists in something good as a perversion of the good, like rust on metal, okay? So God did not create evil, okay? See, God did not create evil. He created the possibility of evil, which is called human and angelic free will. We actualize the possibility of evil by disobeying God, okay? God, in other words, God created a good creation, but he gave us the freedom to pervert and corrupt his creation. And that's what evil is. God created a perfect garden. He created us with the ability to trash his garden, and we did, and we've been suffering the consequences ever since. Another way of presenting the problem of evil is that an all-good God would not want evil to exist. An all-powerful God can prevent evil from existing. But evil exists. Therefore, no all-good, all-powerful God exists, okay? There's a hidden premise there. Atheists acknowledge now that there's a hidden premise there, so that argument is they no longer use, that's called a deductive argument against God from evil. Now they acknowledge that that doesn't work, so now they're trying an inductive argument. Deductive argument proves its conclusion with absolute certainty. They acknowledge they lost. Alan Planning, A God, Evil, and I forget what the whole title is, but he pronounced the death of that argument. And so now they argue, well, the amount of evil in the world today isn't consistent with the existence of an all-good, all-powerful God. But whatever the case, we can just change a few words and it makes sense. An all-good God would want to defeat evil. An all-powerful God is able to defeat evil. Evil exists, therefore an all-good, all-powerful God either will defeat evil or is in the process of defeating evil. You see, there's an unnecessary time limit placed on God. The hidden premise, though, really, when it comes down to it, is that they used to act as if they knew that there was no greater good that could come out of God, an all-good, all-powerful God, allowing evil and human suffering. So if we just say an all-good, all-powerful God allows evil and human suffering for the purposes of a greater good, but he is also in the process through Christ's death, resurrection, and return, he's in the process of defeating evil, we've got the whole ball of wax. You see, they act like, here's something you Christians never thought about, evil and human suffering. You've never been in a hospital and saw someone dying on their death. It's like, what in the world are you atheists talking about? We built the hospitals, okay? We're still the ones who send the missionaries out to third world countries to feed the hungry. We know what suffering's about. We're the ones who invented orphanages. And this idea that evil's supposed to shock us, God would not have written this book if it wasn't for Genesis chapter 3. You see, when it comes down to it, the problem of evil is not just the atheist problem is not that he emphasizes evil too much. He doesn't emphasize it enough. Evil is not just some theoretical, philosophical problem. See, the atheist is saying, if Christianity is true, then these things would be cases of evil and human suffering. See, the atheist, what he's not saying is, I don't believe Christianity is true, so I don't believe there's any such thing as evil. So the guy dying on his deathbed, the example you gave me in that debate, Mr. Atheist, you really can't call that evil, can you? Well, no.